latest from the world of technology. This is the Tech Guide Podcast with Stephen Fenwick.
I quite like the number of apps that are already available.
Tech Guide.
The iPad 2 still beats just about everything on the market. The new iPad has just kicked away even further.
Tech Guide.
I quite enjoyed using it. Great design. The operating system worked hand in hand with the hardware as well.
Keeping you updated and educated. This is the Tech Guide Podcast.
This is obviously a hot selling device.
Tech Guide.
You know, we want them to be light. We want them to be portable. And this one's very fast with i7 and i5 processors.
Now, from the studios of techguide.com.au, Stephen Fenwick.
Tech Guide, episode 2. Thanks for listening. Thanks for downloading. I'm Stephen Fenwick, editor of techguide.com.au. And on this week's show, we'll be taking a look at Sony's Google TV internet player. We'll also check out what lies ahead with Windows Phone 8. And we'll also find out why Apple has to pay a $2.55 million fine. We'll also be talking Mog, the latest music streaming service to hit Australia. And in our reviews, we'll be running our eye over Plantronics Backbeat Go wireless in-ear headphones. We'll also check out the Sony HX850 Smart TV. And also an app that can help you get the cheapest prices on your booze. In this week's interview, we'll also be speaking to Ron Curry, who's the head of the Interactive Game and Entertainment Association, about the R18 Plus rating finally coming to gaming. And in the Tech Guide Help Desk, we'll talk tablets v laptops, find the right printer for you and your needs, and we'll also tell you how to sync your iPhone, iPod, and iPad to multiple computers. So let's get cracking.
You're listening to Tech Guide with Stephen Fenwick.
Now, just yesterday, that's Monday, we're recording this on a Tuesday night here, on a Monday night, sorry, so earlier today, we had a look at the Sony Google TV for the first time. We were invited up to Sony's headquarters up there in North Ryde, and we were shown this Google TV internet player. So it's a standalone device, a box that connects to your TV via HDMI. But it's more than just a smart TV adapter or an add-on, if you like. It allows people to dive a little bit deeper into their content. So it's got its own Google Chrome browser. It's also got access to a lot of content outside the traditional sort of walled garden content we see today with smart TVs on the market already. But what I really liked about it too, Tech Guide had a hands-on session with Google TV earlier today. What we liked the most, though, I quite liked the two-sided remote control. Now, on one side, there was a full QWERTY keyboard, so it allows you to type if you want to type in a web address, you want to do a search, you want to write an email, update your status. It was quite easy to type using this keyboard. So it's about the size of a phone, this smart remote. But on the other side, there was also a trackpad, which made it easy to navigate the page, the web page, or the screen. And the trackpad also was the mouse button. So if you wanted to double click, all you had to do was tap on that trackpad as well. So we've used a lot of smart TVs. I've reviewed a number of them over the last few weeks, actually, and we find that while the internet experience is great and the connectivity is excellent, just being able to navigate on the screen with a remote control can be a little bit difficult. But with the Google TV, I think they've found the right formula there with that new remote control. Now, here's the catch, though. Google TV, it's going to be available from Thursday, June the 28th. But it's only available when you buy a Sony Bravia HX750 or HX850 television from this week. It will not be available in the foreseeable future, as far as we know, as a standalone device. So if you just bought a Sony TV today or yesterday, you are not going to get your free Google TV. If you buy it Wednesday, you're not going to get the free Google TV. So you need to wait till Thursday, June 28th to get your Google TV. Now, what I'm thinking, though, Google TV has been in the US for a while, offers all this content, also offers access to all the Android apps, and there are some specifically designed for the TV screen, by the way, so there's some good additions to the Google Play Store there. But what I'm thinking, in the years ahead, I'd say as early as probably next year, we're probably going to see this Google TV, this device, actually absorbed into the TV, so it'll become part of the TV, if you like. I think you will probably see some smart the Bravia Smart TV range with a little subtitle saying, powered by Google TV. Now, Sony wouldn't confirm that. I asked them the question. They said, oh, we've got no information about that. But I'd say it's a pretty good bet that we're going to see Google TV not only as a standalone device with your Sony TV, but I think it'll eventually work its way inside the TV so you don't have to add that extra box to your entertainment unit. Now, if you want some more information, I've done a full report on techguide.com.au.
This is Tech Guide with Stephen Fenwick.
Now, there's been a lot of buzz lately about Windows Phone. Now, that operating system, that other operating system that's out there, it's not iOS, it's not Android, but it's Windows Phone. Now, I've got to say, I'm a bit of a fan of the Windows Phone platform and a fan of the devices, especially that Nokia have created for their Lumia range. Now, Nokia made a pretty big deal, announcement early last year that they were going to partner up with Microsoft to create the Nokia, going to create the hardware, Microsoft going to bring the software in the form of Windows Phone, and they're going to bring out their all of Nokia's smartphones running the Windows Phone system. Now, they've the Lumia 800, I've reviewed on Tech Guide, I rate it as a smartphone, an excellent little device. They've also just recently released the Nokia Lumia 900, which has got a larger screen, a little bit of a faster processor, and just a few more capabilities. But what we saw last week, there was a convention, the Windows Phone Summit in San Francisco last week, and it revealed Windows Phone 8. Now, we all know that Windows 8 is due out later this year. So this Windows Phone 8 is drawing a lot of the capabilities from Windows, which is the most widely used operating system in the world. But and so you're gonna see it inherit a lot of Windows 8 features, including the tile system, which we already see on Windows Phone 7.5. But what they did outline, though, some of the main features for Windows Phone 8. And the first of those is a new start screen. Now, that's your home screen, if you like. And what it allows you to do in its current form, it allows you to pin your favorite tiles to your home page. So rather than you having to scroll through all your apps on the second page, you can see everything on your home page, on your start page. You can scroll down as far as you want, and these live tiles display information. Like, for example, if you've had 4 missed phone calls, it'll have the number 4 in your telephone box, in your telephone tile there. If you've got 2 unread emails, it'll say it'll have a number 2 in your email tile. And that kind of live information, so rather than you having to dive into the app, you can see at a glance what's happening in that particular app. So, but what Windows Phone 8 is going to allow is for you to actually manually customize the size of the tiles on your home screen. So you, at the moment, you can only fit 2 tiles side by side across the width of the screen. But with Windows Phone 8, it'll allow you to fit up to 4 tiles across the screen. Some tiles you can even stretch across the whole width of the screen. For example, the messaging tile, you might be able to stretch it to the full width of the screen, and then be able to see the actual message. Once you get a new message, you'll be able to read the whole message in that tile rather than having to open up the app once you see just the number on the edge of the app there. So that's one advantage. So it also allows people to fit more tiles on the front of their device and also customize it to suit their needs, to suit their tastes. So if you're into your gaming, if you're into, you know, you it's a business phone, you want your email and all your browser at the top of the page, it allows you to do that. Another new feature is multi-core support. At the moment, Windows Phone only the Windows phones on the market are single core processors. So now what Windows Phone 8 is going to provide is support for multi-core processors. So the powerful handsets that are in the near future that we're going to see will work quite well with Windows Phone 8. Another thing Windows Phone 8 will support is 2 new screen resolutions, the 1280 by 768, 1280 by 720. So for those larger screens, we're seeing a lot of larger displays coming out now. The Galaxy S3, for example, 4.8-inch screen. That's quite a big screen. At the moment, the Windows Phone 7 screens on the Lumia, I think, are 3.7, and I think the new one is 4.4-inch screen. So bigger, sharper screens for Windows Phone 8. But another couple of other features really quickly before we wrap up on this one is NFC sharing. So near field communications for you to turn your phone kind of into a wallet so it can make these transactions, contactless payment in various stores. But it'll also allow you to share information by touching compatible phones back to back. You can share files and things pretty quickly. It'll also have a wallet functionality too, where you can store all of your credit card information, securely, of course, debit cards, things like boarding passes and other information that we carry around like that. So keep an eye out for that. That's launching later this year. Plenty of features there to look forward to. And, yeah, Windows Phone 8, there's a full report on techguide.com.au. Well, Apple is in the news again, but not for reasons the company would like. Late last week, the company was fined $2.55 million for misleading advertising and packaging on the new iPad. Now, the issue comes with the claims of its 4G capabilities. Now, we all know when the device was released back in March, there was the Wi-Fi only version and the Wi-Fi plus 4G version. Now, the company has a uniform message across the whole world with the packaging, with the names of the products. And unfortunately, though, for Australians, 4G didn't quite fit the label accurately. And so the ACCC took Apple to court. They lodged their court action back in March, and they subsequently won the case, and Apple have now been fined $2.55 million for misleading advertising, which is basically for not the 4G not being compatible here in Australia. Despite the device being called a Wi-Fi plus 4G, it just wasn't compatible with Australia's networks. Now, Justice Bromberg of the Federal Court in Victoria handed down his decision late last week, and he said that Apple's desire for this global uniformity was given a greater priority than the need to comply with Australian consumer law. Now, that's quoting Justice Bromberg from the federal court from last week. So, as a result, Apple have to cough up $2.55 million. Now, that may seem a drop in the bucket for Apple. I think they've got $100 billion in the bank. So, I don't think this is going to send the company broke. But by the same token, the justice did say that this has caused a little bit of damage to the Apple brand. But Apple, to their credit, since the decision came down some time ago, the fine was only announced last week, but Apple have been cooperative with the decision. They've even offered customers refunds for anyone who was misled, anyone who thought it was 4G compatible and discovered that it isn't. They've been given full refunds. There's even signs now at point of sale to describe the fact that the 4G described in the device previously won't work here in Australia. In fact, they've gone ahead and changed the packaging and the name of the product here in Australia. It's no longer called Wi-Fi plus 4G. It's called Wi-Fi plus cellular. So Apple, $2.5 million fine. And if you want to read the full report, it's on techguide.com.au. Well, it's another week and another music streaming service. So we've already seen RDO and Spotify, among others, recently, but the latest is called Mog. And this is a music streaming service that's partnered here in Australia with Telstra. Now, it's the usual deal with the music streaming service. You can pay $11.99 and get access to up to 16 million tracks. And you can also, they're subscribed to a desktop version, which is $6.99 for those who don't want to take their music with them. But for those who do want to subscribe, not only on their computer, but also enjoy their music on the go, it's $11.99 a month. And you can download the Mog app from mog.com, that's M-O-G.com, for your computer. And also, you can also download the compatible smartphone and tablet app to listen to it on your iPhone, on your Android smartphone. So you can, if you want to just try out the service, the good news is you can get a free 14-day trial. You just need to register at www.mog.com, but it seems yet another music streaming service. Now, for those of you who are contemplating maybe getting into one of these music services, might be Mog, and the good news if you are a Telstra customer using the Mog service is that the data that you use for streaming your music doesn't count against your monthly data limit, whether you're at home or a Telstra mobile customer, so you can download as much music, stream as much music, and it won't be counted against your monthly data limit. But I think the question needs to be asked, if you do want to get into these streaming services, you just got to ask yourself, do you spend $12 a month on music? Times that by 12, if you're buying a CD a month, then you are spending more than the price to participate in these music streaming services, so you probably get better value for money if you want to jump in and stream your music rather than buying CDs or buying the individual tracks or albums from iTunes and other places like that. But you do have to remember, though, if you are a member of these services, you can download and cache some of the songs on your device, but the minute you cut off your membership, that's it. All your music disappears. So it pays to belong. Your music stays with you as long as you're a member of those services. That applies to Mog, RDO, Spotify, Rara.com, all of those services that we've spoken about that are featured on Tech Guide. So if you are interested in that, head over to Tech Guide. There's a full story there with all of your information.
Tech Guide. Now, a Tech Guide review with Stephen Fenwick.
Let's kick off this week's review with the Plantronics Backbeat Go. Now, Plantronics, as we all know, is very well known in the Bluetooth department. They make a lot of Bluetooth headsets and devices to wirelessly pair with your smartphones and tablets and other products. They also make a few good audio products. And in this case, the Backbeat Go are their lightest and smallest wireless in-ear headphones. Now, we've seen wireless headphones, so the over the head with a head strap. Those big headphones that are wireless, plenty of those on the market. They need receivers and they're quite complicated. There are some that use Bluetooth, but haven't seen hardly any in-ear headphones. So not the headphones, the earphones. And Plantronics Backbeat Go is that product. Now, the only cable you're going to find on the Backbeat Go is the cable that connects the left earbud and the right earbud. There's no cable that you need to connect to your smartphone or your tablet or whatever audio source you happen to be using. So I've tested them out in the last week. They're very light. They only weigh 13 grams, so you're not even going to know you're wearing them. But they provide decent music quality. I'm a bit of a stickler for good audio, and these work very good. They provide a really nice detail and pretty respectable bass. So if you like to hear your music on the go without having to literally be tethered to your device with a cable connecting it to your iPhone or your smart Android smartphone or whatever player you happen to be listening to, the Plantronics Backbeat Go, yeah, they're pretty comfortable to wear. They've also got an inline remote control, so you can control your music. You can make and receive calls. If a call comes in, you can turn up the volume, navigate your music. So it is compatible with, obviously, the iPhones, iPods, and the iPad. And all that. Those volume controls also work on Android devices as well. So check out the full review at techguide.com.au.
You're listening to Tech Guide with Stephen Fenwick.
Now, we had another smart TV in the Tech Guide offices last week, and this time out we had the Sony HX850. Now, this made the news a couple of months ago when it was announced that it was coming onto the market. This was the TV that the managing director of Sony Australia, Carl Rose, proclaimed quite boldly. I love the fact that he had that much confidence in the product. He declared that the Sony HX850 was the television to beat in the Australian market. So I thought, you know, we're going to get this into the Tech Guide offices and check it out. And I have to say that for what they do best in terms of picture quality, creating that really nice screen, a decent design, it did the job admirably. The picture quality is probably the best, one of the best we've seen on a smart TV. The device we reviewed was the HX850, the 55-inch model. So it wasn't a small TV. And you had your choice of two stands. It either had a desktop stand, a tabletop stand, or the larger, longer base, so that it actually positioned the TV on a slight angle. The monolith design, as they call it on the Bravia, would sit at a slight angle, the perfect viewing angle. The base also had built-in speakers. But so that's an added cost if you do want to invest in the HX850 base. But in terms of performance, it'll be a smart TV, so you can connect to all your favorite apps, things like Twitter and Facebook, and also to content. Now, Sony have got a lot of skin in the game, not only in terms of providing the hardware, but they also provide a lot of content through Sony Pictures, Sony Music, and Sony Gaming too, through the PlayStation Network. So that was all readily accessible through the dashboard on the HX850. But one little thing that I was a little bit disappointed with, especially since we're seeing all the competitors from Samsung and LG, Toshiba, all coming out with really nice slimline bezels, frames that you could hardly see on the TV, whereas Sony's HX850 looked very much like last year's model, didn't try to make those frames a lot thinner. I think if Sony flexed their design muscle on this TV, it would have looked pretty special. Maybe we can hold out for that for next year. So the HX850 850. As I said, I reviewed the 55-inch model, which is priced at $3,699. So if you want to read the full review, head over to techguide.com.au. Now, most people out there, they love a drink, and finding the booze at the right price can be a bit of a struggle. Rather than scouring through the newspaper to find the specials at your local bottle shop, there's a new app that's been released called Deals to Drink. And what this app does, it's for the iPhone and Android. What it does, it allows you to choose your area and also choose the type of alcohol you're looking for. So beer, wine, spirits, and it will then pinpoint the six locations in your area offering the best prices. Now, this is important because not only does it save you time, but it can also save you a fair bit of money, because prices, according to Deals to Drink, their research, they said that prices in Australia can vary up to 30% from one bottle shop to another. So if you don't shop around, you're not looking in the newspaper or not using this app, you could be paying tens and maybe, you know, up to $30, $40, $50 more for your favorite alcohol. So if you want to drink and you want to save a little bit of money, I think it's a good idea to head over to Deals to get the Deals to Drink app on your smartphone.
Tech Guide. Now, a Tech Guide interview.
Well, the R18 plus rating for gaming is finally going to become a reality. And this is a battle that's been going on for up to 10 years. I think it's 10 years since this action was initially launched. Now, the background of this is the fact that gaming, very popular exercise here in Australia, but the top rating before this was an MA 15 plus. Now, the problem for that was that it wasn't on an equal footing with other forms of entertainment. There was R rating for films, but no R rating for gaming. And this was something that made it a little bit harder for parents and customers to distinguish the games that were designed for people who are a little bit older. If a game didn't meet this MA 15 plus rating, it had to either be banned or modified to fit into that MA 15 plus rating. Now, finally, legislation has been passed through in the federal parliament to allow an R18 plus rating for gaming, which is huge news because, as I said, it's been going on for quite some time. But what it'll finally do, it'll finally give gaming an equal footing with movies, TV shows, books. And it's such a popular form of entertainment too. I think the revenue generated by gaming in Australia, both on the software and the hardware side, probably adds up to more than we spend at the Australian box office. So that might surprise a few people. But what might also surprise a few people is that the age of people playing games. Now, we're about to talk to Ron Curry, the CEO of the Interactive Games and Entertainment Association, who's going to tell us a little bit more, but he's going to also reveal the average age of the Australian gamer here in our Tech Guide interview. Well, Ron, thanks for joining us. Tell us, what does this R18 plus rating mean for gaming?
What it means now is that adults will be able to get access to adult appropriate content or age appropriate content. So up to now, we've said to gamers that, you know, if you're over 15 years old, too bad, you can only play a game suitable for a 15-year-old. Now what we're saying is, you know, there's content out there that's age appropriate, the narrative is for an adult, and now you can enjoy that content.
And it's been a long time coming. This has been quite a battle. It's been going on for a number of years now, and you've obviously been at the forefront of that. What made the government change their mind?
I think it's just a slow dripping effect, you know, that the erosion. So we've constantly been in their ear for 10 years. What we've also seen is consumers, you know, the gamers have now, I guess, stepped up the way they communicate with government. You know, if we go back 5 or 6 years, the consumers were writing notes to government saying, you know, you're a bunch of whatevers, you know. But what we saw over the last few years, some really constructive engagement with gamers who are writing the government in quite a mature way, saying, you know, we're adults, we need to be treated like adults. And that was a tipping point, I think. We saw some retailers, EB did some petitions last year about it, some submissions. There was, you know, 40,000 or 50,000 gamers that took the time to say to the government, you know what, it's time for a change.
And a lot of people, there's a bit of misconception though. A lot of people that, when they first heard about the battle to get an R18 plus rating for gaming, there were a lot of misconceptions that people thought that just meant that we wanted more sex and violence and gore in games. So that was a bit of a stumbling block too, don't you think?
It was, and you know, a couple of the lobby groups who were against it were going out saying, well, you know, we're going to have rape and we're going to have this extreme violence and it's going to be horrible. But you know, what we try to remind them is there's still an RC category. There's still stuff that's completely inappropriate. And that was a message that took us a while. We had to break through that noise. and through that moral panic and say, you know what, you know, there are games that are going to be maybe a little bit more violent and they're going to contain more adult narrative, but we're not going to go right to that extreme. We just simply can't do that.
And you mentioned earlier, like, this is really going to help identify the games that are age-appropriate. It's really going to make it easier for parents too, don't you think?
Yeah, what we've seen is, and some people believe that there was probably content in MA 15+ that, you know, maybe should have gone to R if there was a category. So when we get the new guidelines, we'll probably see that. Some of that content will move to R. But we also knew the absence of an R classification didn't mean an absence of R product in the country. Mm-hmm. Kids were importing it, they were downloading it, they were copying it. And what we kept saying is, let's put a big black sticker on the front and say to parents, you know, that means this isn't suitable for 18-year-olds. Or, sorry, for minors. What they were doing is looking at a sticker that said MA 15+ and think, you know, I've got a 13-year-old. Yeah, he's okay or she's okay. We'll give it to them. And we'll say, well, you know what? An R label makes a much bigger statement to parents than an MA 15 does.
And just in terms of the average gamer, where there's often been stats and things that are showing the average gamer, there'll be a lot of people surprised to hear the average age of the gamer. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, we know the average age of a gamer is 33 years old. They've been playing games for 12 years. We also know that about 78% of parents play games with their kids. So, you know, we've moved away from that, you know, spotty youth, you know, 16-year-old sitting, you know, in their bedroom with the lights off. We know that's not a gamer. You know, a gamer's just as likely to be a 50-year-old woman with a uni degree.
And the games industry itself is like the Gen G games are very popular, aren't they? It's not like it's all designed for over 18s. There is, you mentioned families play together, so G rated games are probably the most popular. But this R rating now gives it a sort of an equal footing now with other forms of entertainment in terms of classification.
Yeah, certainly. If you look at the games classified over the last 12 months, over 50% are G or PG. You know, the vast majority. The games that sat in RC, so that, you know, which may be, you know, R if we get an R or when we get an R, were about 0.3%. So, you know, the vast majority of games and what people are enjoying definitely sit in the G or the PG category.
But the significance of this too is that now gaming can be considered on an equal footing with other forms of entertainment, don't you think?
Oh, certainly on equal footing. And in actual fact, if you look at what's happening globally, you know, the world's biggest release, entertainment release, wasn't a movie, it was a video game.
Ron, really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Now, answering all your tech questions, the Tech Guide Help Desk.
Well, the Tech Guide Help Desk this week, we've had a few questions into the forum here at Tech Guide. And if you do want to have your question answered, or you have something that you need to, you want an opinion on a product, or you're having a problem with a device or something not connecting properly at home, be sure to head over to the techguide.com.au forums. That's on the top right hand corner of the menu bar is our forum menu selection. And that'll take you into the forum, which will allow you to leave a question, whether it's about a mobile, about a computer, a television, digital camera, any type of gadget, and we'll get around to answering them. But this week, we've been asked the question, the person's asked the question about whether they need to buy a tablet or a laptop computer. They can't decide whether they're going to spend the money on a laptop or get a tablet. Now, this is really the best way to answer this question would be to really look at what you're going to do with the device. Are you going to just use it to mainly consume content, read emails, browse the web, things like that, or are you going to use it to create documents, PowerPoint presentations, do things like where you're going to actually be producing more content rather than consuming more content? They're the questions you really need to ask yourself. And I think if you're leaning towards more just a lean-back device, you're going to sit in front of the TV to use either to check your email, browse the web, use apps, play games, then I'd probably say you're leaning towards the tablet side. But if you sort of want to be a little bit more productive, you want to create some documents or write something or do a little bit more, something a little bit more involved that needs a little bit more processing power, maybe like a bit of editing, whether it's pictures or video, then a laptop or in that case a desktop might be the best option. But you know, the tablets, though, in their defense, they do also have a lot of accessories so that you can buy keyboards, wireless keyboards, Bluetooth keyboards to use with the tablets. They also come with a variety of stands, even cases with built-in keyboards so you can have that tactile feel of keys under your fingers there. So I think it's you really do need to ask yourself the question whether you're going to consume content or produce content to come up with the right solution.
Keeping you updated and educated. This is Tech Guide with Stephen Fenwick.
Now, here at Tech Guide, we've been asked many questions about printers. Now, printers are a product that a lot of people are, they're dazzled by the cheap prices in the store. They can see they can buy a printer for $39 in the store, even cheapest in some cases, and they snap them up. But what they don't realise is that these printers, while they may be cheap, they burn through their ink cartridges quite quickly. Now, I had a chat in a JB Hi-Fi store about this particular subject a few weeks ago, and that while people, if say a printer's worth $40, as I said, it's going to burn through those cartridges a little bit quicker. So what I'd advise is if you're going to do a lot of printing, then maybe aim to spend a little bit more at the point of purchase. So maybe spend $80, $100 on the printer, maybe even more. And what you'll find is that the ink cartridges will last you a little bit longer. When you buy a $39 printer and you come to update all of your four ink cartridges, they can be up to four in one single printer, you're going to find you're going to be spending more money on the ink cartridges than you did on the actual printer. And in some cases, I've even seen people throw out the printer rather than buying, spending more than what they spent on the printer. They go throw everything out and go buy another $39 printer because it works out cheaper. But if to get around all of that, I think if you're going to do a lot of printing, check out how much printing you're going to actually do. And then maybe aim to spend a little bit more. It'll burn through your ink cartridges a little bit slower, designed for those sort of people with high printing output. So check to see, ask yourself the question before you head out and spend your money on a printer, whether you're going to do a lot of printing, a little bit of printing, because it could be a big difference in your savings. Now, one question we get often asked is with people, especially people with iPhones and iPads and iPods that want to connect them to multiple computers. Now, what happens is that if you've got more than one computer in the house or more than one iPod or iPad in the house and you want to access your content across a number of computers, you want to be able to drag songs on from one computer or videos on from another, there is a way to do it. Now, what happens though initially is that by default, any device connected to iTunes is set to a setting called automatically sync songs. And what that does, once you connect that and you try to drag in some other content that's not associated with the computer that the device was connected to originally, it brings up quite an alarming little warning. The fact that if you do attempt to sync with another library, it's going to wipe out everything and start from scratch. So rather than hitting the panic button here, the best thing to do is to go into the preferences in iTunes. So once you're connected to the device will come up on the left-hand side of your iTunes page on the application, and then just click above it into the summary section. So there's a tab there called summary, music, podcasts, iTunes, your photos. Click on summary, and that'll give you a summary of when your iPad software was last updated, and it'll also give you another option of opening iTunes when the device is connected, things like that. But one particular item you really need to look at, one option, is to check the manually manage music and videos option. And what this does, this frees up your iPod or iPhone or iPad or whatever device you're connecting to connect with multiple computers and just drag and dropping your content across those devices. So don't get that scary warning that that everything's going to be wiped off your device. So check that out in iTunes. There's actually a little tutorial that we've written in the Tech Guide guides at the bottom left-hand corner of the screen there. So do yourself a favor. If you've got multiple iPods, iPads, iPods, and want to share all the content, there is a way to do it. Well, that's our show for another week. Thank you for listening. Be sure to get onto iTunes and subscribe. We'd also like to hear from you, so give us a rating. But also send in your questions if you want to get them answered on the Tech Guide podcast and in our help desk section. So until next time, we hope you enjoyed that, and we'll see you next week.